Can you think of a time when your plans went awry or life seemed to fall in a heap? Think about what was happening. How did you feel? Maybe you'd done something wrong or others had thrown a spanner in the works. Perhaps the whole thing was out of your control. I wonder if you've ever felt that God was against you. It's true that no matter how careful we are, how much we plan, we just can't guarantee our success or our safety. What we can be sure of is this: God cares for his children, and whatever happens in our lives, in the world, he has the best intentions for us. Indeed, for everyone, he has his purposes from the foundation of the world and the means to fulfill them. And you know what? God has disclosed his plan to us. Here it is, from Ephesians chapter 1. God has made known to us the mystery of his will, according to his good pleasure, which he purposed in Christ, to be put into effect when the times reach their fulfillment, to bring unity to all things in heaven and on earth under Christ. As John Piper says, God has purpose for himself, and God will fulfill that purpose. In relationship to the created world, God both preserves the order of all things and guides them towards his intended end. So it's all about him and his plan. Whatever takes place in our lives is working to that end. The term for that is providence, and we'll see something we're working out in the first 2 weeks of our brief series that begins today. We'll be spending 2 weeks in 5 Old Testament books, including Jonah, Lamentations, Ezra, and Esther. And today, we come to the first of the 2 weeks we're devoting to the book of Ruth, probably written about 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus, telling of events that happened 200 years or so earlier. When we mention Ruth, what do you think of? Anybody like to tell me?
Naomi,
right, yes. That's interesting. You think of Naomi in the book's called Ruth. Maybe you think of other things as well. As we go on, I'm sure you'll say, oh yes, I was thinking of that too. The Old Testament book of Judges describes events during Israel's history between about 1400 years before Jesus until Saul became king in about 1050 before Jesus. It was a period when the people were settling the promised land but failing to keep God's commands. There's a recurring cycle. The people fall away from God. They suffer because of their disobedience and idolatry. They cry out to God, and God sends a deliverer, known as a judge, who overcomes their enemies, and after a time of dedication to the Lord, the people again fall away, and the process continues. The writer often says, there was no king in the land. I wonder what the writer was getting at there. Then, at the end of Judges, the author expands on his comment like this: in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Was that the reason for the people's sin and their failure to obey God's rules? Everyone did as they saw fit. Would you say that's true about today? I guess you would. How do people's sin and disobedience affect God's plan? It's one for you to think about over the next couple of weeks. The book of Ruth is set in that period, the time of the judges. The contrast is that the main characters of the story are trying to live their lives in keeping with their commitment to him. The NIV Study Bible introduction to Ruth says, the book gives a series of intimate glimpses into the private lives of the members of an Israelite family. It also presents a delightful account of the remnant of true faith and piety in the period of the Judges, relieving an otherwise wholly dark picture of that era. As I knew I was going to have to speak about Ruth, I decided I would read Judges first. And I have to tell you, it's a depressing book. If you don't remember from the time we read it a little while back, just spend a little while reading. The last few chapters are absolutely awful. Yet, here's Ruth in contrast. It sits in the Bible just after Judges. I hope you'll take some time in this coming week, perhaps, to read Ruth, maybe more than once. It won't take you long, perhaps an hour or two. I'm sure you'll enjoy it and find plenty to think about regarding people's plans and God's purposes. So, as we come to the start of the book, we meet, first of all, a desperate family that takes a fateful journey 80 kilometres southeast of Bethlehem. It would have taken them about 7 to 10 days on foot. So we read from the beginning of Ruth. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was... Very good. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Oh, you can cheat by reading up there, can't you? They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah, and the other Ruth. After they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. So we see Elimelech, his wife, and their two unmarried sons travel from their established situation in the region of Bethlehem, leaving their kinfolk and fellow Jews, and go to live in a heathen place because of a famine. They went to Moab. After the conquest of Canaan, the relations of Moab with Israel are of a mixed character, sometimes warlike, sometimes peaceful. The Moabites were worshippers of Chemosh, a god to whom human sacrifices were made. Although intermarriage with Moabites was not forbidden, the Moabite partner and their children were not allowed to enter the assembly of the Lord. So why go to Moab? Elimelech must have been desperate if he embarked on such a journey. Matthew Henry, who published a commentary on the whole Bible in 1706, is very critical of the decision Elimelech made. He says, "It is an evidence of a discontented, distrustful, unstable spirit to be weary of the place in which God has set us and to be for leaving it immediately whenever we meet with any uneasiness or inconvenience in it." I don't think he holds back, does he? Is this another example of people doing right in their own eyes and not relying on the Lord's faithfulness to his promise? At this point, we know nothing about the men in the party other than their names. We don't know if any of them had a living faith in the Lord. But we shall see that Naomi, Elimelech's wife, certainly did. We also don't discover much more about the men apart from their being involved in the sadness that befalls the family in the 10 years following and a long way from their homeland. First, Elimelech died and his sons married Moabite women. After 10 years, during which they had no children, the sons died. Naomi was in a perilous position as a widow in a foreign land and without the prospect of an heir. What a test for faith. When we go through difficulties, even disastrous times that include sadness and devastation, we can learn from Naomi's example of always counting on God and recalling his faithfulness no matter what. Naomi could recall the way God had rescued his people and led them into the promised land. We're blessed to remember God's outrageous grace in rescuing the world through our Lord Jesus Christ, the means of grace and the hope of glory. So we go on to verse 6. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she'd been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back each of you to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you've shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We'll go back with you to your people." Naomi had some contact from home. Even though she was suffering such sorrow, when the news came through that there was now food in Israel, she acknowledged it was because the Lord had come to the aid of his people in line with his covenant. And so the little party prepared to return to her homeland, where she could be relatively more secure. Perhaps Naomi remembered how she felt as a stranger in a foreign land when she was ready. Sorry, perhaps Naomi remembered how she had felt as a stranger in a foreign land when she was ready to release her daughters-in-law from any obligation they felt they had to her, so they could stay with their own people. She prays the Lord will provide a home and a new husband for each of them. But Orpah and Ruth seemed determined to accompany Naomi to Bethlehem. Verse 11. But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grow up? Would you remain unmarried to them? Sorry, would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." Naomi uses the name of her covenant-keeping God, the Lord, even when she's speaking about him turning against her. She's in a tough situation. Why should these younger women, still able to have children, not needing to remain widows, stay with her? Once more, she encourages them to stay in Moab. She feels somehow that the Lord is against her, but she stays faithful to God despite the hardness and loneliness of her life at this point. Where else could she go? Now, it's time for you to think, if you're not doing so already. What was the right thing for the young women to do? Imagine you were in the position, in their position. Naomi's saying, "Go home, find yourself a husband and a home in your own country." Okay? What would you do? Now, you've got a couple of seconds. Those of you who would stay in Moab, lift your hands, please. Thank you. I see those hands. All right. Now, does that mean... No, I don't know. Which of you would go back with Naomi? It's pretty even. There's a few of you halting between two opinions. Well, in my mind, the offer that was made by Naomi at that point was, as voting suggested, they were being offered the right thing to do, and a good thing to do, and to go with Naomi would have been a noble thing to do. Bit hard to tell, isn't it? Perhaps there's a question for a question box about what you do when you've got two decisions and they're both equally right. How do you choose? I'll leave that. I was going to talk about it, but I've got too much more to say, so we won't go into that one. Verse 14. At this, they wept aloud. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. That's to Naomi, of course. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and their gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and where and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging. I wonder why Ruth made a different choice to Orpah. The clues are there, aren't they? Ruth was not only deciding to stay with her mother-in-law, but also to become one of God's people. Here was a Gentile committing herself to Israel's Lord and showing the same acceptance of God's dealings as her mother-in-law did. Was this the first time Ruth had openly expressed her trust in the Lord? What she did was also accompanied by a costly decision to stay with Naomi wherever she went. Her faith was shown in her actions. Do you remember what James says in his letter in the New Testament about faith and deeds? Yes. Faith without works is dead, or as the later translation, faith without deeds is dead. That's in James 2:26. But what great joy for Naomi to hear the declaration of faith and care from Ruth. For 10 years or more, Ruth had seen how Naomi's faith sustained her through sadness and sorrow. Who can tell the impact of the way believers hold on to their faith through the ups and downs of life? But rest assured, how you react in tough times is evident to many people. Your colleagues at work, your children, your grandchildren, your nieces, your nephews, your in-laws and neighbours. And what a joy it is when one becomes a believer because of the steadfast faith of a relative. God can use you to show the attractiveness of a life committed to Him. As we'll see, Ruth's decision turns out, which seems to be a phrase that keeps turning up in these verses, turns out to be a significant moment in the fulfillment of God's plans for creation. Verse 19. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara." That is bitter. "Because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Caused a stir when the mother and her daughter-in-law returned to Bethlehem, over 10 years since Naomi, her husband, and their sons had left for Moab. The men of the town were at the barley harvest, and it was the women who wondered if this really could be Naomi. Excuse me. Coming back to the village, they played on her name, which means pleasant, when she was probably looking anything but. She says, "Call me bitter because of my misfortune at the Lord's hands." Excuse me. However, the beginning of this barley harvest was a good time to be coming home. Now the writer introduces another character about to enter the story. Now at this point, Ruth was evidently not aware of his existence, let alone his relationship to her mother-in-law. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Nobody mentioned Boaz when we thought of Ruth there. God had instructed the Israelites to care for the poor and needy living among them. There were particular commands about harvesting. Listen to what they say and the people who would benefit from them. Look too for the basis that God gives for the rules. First of all, from Leviticus 23:22, When you reap the harvest of the land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 19, when you're harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless and the widow, so the Lord your God may bless you in all the works of your hands. We go back to chapter 2 of Ruth. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favour. Naomi said to her, thank you, go ahead my daughter. So she went out, entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan, you might remember, of Elimelech. That is Ruth's father-in-law's clan. Ruth had nowhere particular in mind when she ventured out to collect some of the grain left over for the needy. But as it turned out, she was gleaning in a field belonging to Boaz. Turned out. What do you make of that? As luck would have it? Well, this is what the Bible says. Proverbs 16 verse 9. In their heart, humans plan their course, but the Lord establishes their steps. Psalm 37, 23. The Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. The outcome will demonstrate why she came to this particular place on this particular day. Chapter 2, verse 4 of Ruth. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they answered. With his greeting to the workers, Boaz shows his willingness to acknowledge the Lord in his dealings with them. Have you ever had a boss that blessed you like that? I don't see anybody nodding. You know, people don't react adversely when you say, God bless you. You should try it sometime. I try and do it, and it's interesting how people react, but they don't react badly. In the months that I've been doing it, I haven't had anyone saying, what are you talking about, you idiot? In fact, you know, some people react and say, all right, thank you. So, you might be surprised if you try it, whether you're a boss or not. Verse 5. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, who does that young woman belong to? The overseer replied, she is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field. Don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. And wherever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, why have I found such favour in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and your mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. May I continue to find favour in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants. It's possible Ruth had been waiting for Boaz to give the okay for her to collect the gleanings. In any event, Boaz, who's heard about her, her kindness to Naomi, and her commitment to God immediately encourages her to glean in the field and nowhere else. Why do you think Boaz acted that way?
Protection.
He wanted to protect Ruth. Is that what you said? Yeah? Protection. Anything else? Pardon? He liked her. I won't say in what way. Well, maybe I'm pretty staid, but I think he was a kindly, generous man who was moved by Ruth's plight. He was a means of delivering God's blessing in response to his own prayer. Can you think of a time when you prayed for someone or something only to realise God was prompting you to provide the answer yourself? Here's one for you to think about and tell me after. Think of a New Testament situation where that happened. And verse 12 is a beautiful picture of the care that the Lord provides to those who take refuge in him. Here it is again. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. David Atkinson, in another commentary on Ruth, draws together the various Old Testament references to shadowing under God's wings. There, he says, we find safety, refreshment, stillness, help, relaxation, and hope. Verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to Ruth, come over here, have some bread, and dip it in the wine vinegar. When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some of the stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she'd gathered and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town and her mother-in-law saw how much she'd gleaned. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she'd eaten enough. Boaz continues his generosity to the poor visitor, providing her what he did for his staff, but even more than that, making arrangements for her to receive above and beyond what the law required. She carried about 20 kilograms of grain home that evening. Of course, the word we might use to describe Boaz's generosity is grace, a characteristic of God. In older versions of the Old Testament, it's called loving kindness. Here was Boaz showing God's grace to the refugee, helping to provide for needy people. I think it's reasonable to imagine this is what he usually did. It reminded me of Paul's instructions for people that are well off. And by the way, we're all well off. Here it is in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way they'll lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Back to Ruth chapter 2 verse 19. Remember, she's brought 20 kilos and more for the home. Her mother-in-law asked her, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she'd been working. The name of the man I work with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He's not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, That man is our close relative. He's one of our guardian redeemers. Then Ruth the Moabite said, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all the grain. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed. So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Naomi prays a blessing on Boaz for his kindness. Her comment in verse 20 about showing unceasing kindness towards the living and the dead could refer to Boaz's actions or the Lord's. What is clear is that she sees God's grace as being shown to both of them through the kindness of Boaz, whom she identifies as a close relative, one of their kinsmen redeemers. An easy English version rephrases what Naomi said as, the man is a relation of ours. He might redeem us. I have more to say about that next week. At this point in the story, it doesn't seem to cause any significant response from Ruth. She just said, oh well, he told me something else. But how wonderful for them both to see that God is working in their lives and using others, including a close relative, to meet their needs. It so happened. But it was all in the providence of God. Verse 12 from the Easy English Version reads, Boaz said, I ask the Lord to be good to you for what you've done. I pray that the Lord, the God of Israel, will pay you in full. That is because you came to him for a safe place under his wings. Bill's going to show a video now of Ben Trigg's song, Holy Overshadowing. It's sung by Graham Kendrick and Ben Trigg, and after the song, Lee's going to come and lead us in our prayers. Thanks.